easy on you this time. She still remembers the sting of brush-scrubbed feet. I understand, instructor. Carnelian sighs. Then he turns to the boys' side of the dormitory room.
Open your trunks, all of you. Let's get this over with.
There's a lot of grumbling as they open their chests, and enough glares that Demaya knows she's made things worse for herself. They all hate her now, which is fine. If they're going to hate her, she'd rather they do it for a reason. But that might change once this game has played out. Mashish opens his chest along with the rest, sighing mortally as he does so, and her shoes are right there on top of the folded uniforms. When Demaya sees his expression change from annoyance to confusion and then mortification, she feels bad. She doesn't like hurting people. But she watches closely, and the instant Mashish's expression changes to fury, he swings around and glares at someone. She follows his glare, tense, ready, to see that he's looking at Jasper. Yes, that was what she expected. He's the one, then. Jasper, though, has suddenly gone pale. He shakes his head, as if trying to throw off Mashish's accusatory look. It doesn't work. Instructor Carnelian sees all of this. A muscle in his jaw flexes as he glances toward Demaya again. He looks almost angry with her, but why? He must understand that she has to do this.
I see,
he says, as if responding to her thought. Then he focuses on Mashish.
Do you have anything to say for yourself?
Mashish doesn't protest his innocence. She can see by the slump of his shoulders and the shaking of his fists that he knows there's no point. But he's not going down alone. With his head down, he says,
Jasper took her shoes last time. I did not!
Jasper backs away from his bunk in the inspection line into the middle of the room. He's trembling all over. Even his eyes are trembling. He looks ready to cry.
He's lying! He's just trying to pass this off on someone else.
But when Carnelian turns to Jasper, Jasper flinches and goes still. He almost spits the next words.
She sold them for me. Traded them to one of the cleaning comlis in exchange for liquor.
And then he points at crack. Demaya inhales, everything inside her going still with shock.
Crack?
Crack.
You rusting cannibal son whore.
Crack clenches her fists.
You let that old pervert feel you up for liquor and a letter. You know full well he wouldn't give it to us just for shoes. It was from my mother.
Jasper's definitely crying now.
I didn't want him to, but I couldn't. They wouldn't let me write to her.
You liked it, Crack sneers. I told you I'd tell if you said anything, didn't I? Well, I saw you. He had his fingers in you, and you moaned like it felt good, just like the little wannabe breeder you are. Only breeders have standards.
This is wrong. This is all wrong. Everyone's staring at each other, at Crack as she rants, at Demaya, at Jasper as he weeps, at Carnelian. The room is full of gasps and murmurings. That feeling is back. The pent, fraught, not quite reverberation that is Crack's orogeny unfurling itself, and everyone in the room is twitching with it. Or maybe they're twitching at the words and what they mean, because these aren't things grits should know or do. Getting in trouble, sure, they're kids and kids do that. Getting in trouble like this? No.
No,
Jasper wails the word at Crack.
I told you not to tell.
He's sobbing openly now. His mouth works, but nothing more comes out that's intelligible, nothing but a low, despairing moan. Or maybe it's just a continuation of the word no. Impossible to tell, because everyone else is making noise now. Some of them hissing at Crack to shut up, Some sniffing with Jasper, some of them giggling nervously at Jasper's tears, some of them stage whispering at each other for confirmation of things they knew, but didn't believe.
Enough!
The room goes silent with Carnelian's quiet command, except for Jasper's soft hitching. After a moment, Carnelian's jaw flexes.
You, you, and you.
He points at Mashish, Jasper, and Crack.
Come with me.
He walks out of the room. The three grits look at each other, and it's a wonder none of them combust from the sheer hatred in these looks. Then Mashish curses and moves to follow Carnelian. Jasper scrubs a forearm across his face and does the same, his head hanging and fists tight. Crack glares around the room, defiant, until her eyes meet Demaya's. Then Crack flinches. Demaya stares back because she's too stunned to look away, and because she is furious with herself. This is what comes of trusting others. Crack was not her friend, wasn't even someone she liked, but she thought they could at least help each other. Now she's found the head of the snake that's been trying to eat her, and it's halfway down the gullet of a completely different snake. The result is something too obscene to look at, let alone kill. Better you than me, Crack says softly, into the room's silence. Demaya hasn't said anything, hasn't demanded an explanation, but Crack gives her one anyway, right there, in front of everyone. No one says a word. No one even breathes loudly. That was the idea. One more slip-up and all I'm done for but you. You're little citizen perfect. Top scores on all the tests. Perfect control in applied. Not a wrinkle out of place. The instructors wouldn't really do much to you, not yet. And while they were trying to figure out how their star pupil suddenly went wrong, everyone would stop waiting for me to blow up a mountain. Or trying to make me do it. For a while, anyway. Her smile fades and she looks away. That was the idea. Demaya can't say anything. She can't even think. So after a while, Crack shakes her head, sighs, and moves to follow the others after Carnelian. The room is still. Nobody looks at anybody else. Then there's a stir at the door as two other instructors come in and begin examining Crack's bunk and trunk. The grits watch as one woman lifts the mattress and the other ducks under it. There's a brief ripping sound, and the instructor reappears with a big brown flask half full in one hand. She opens the flask and sniffs its contents, grimaces, and nods to the other woman. They both leave. When the echoes of their steps fade, Demaya goes to Mashish's trunk to retrieve her shoes. She closes the lid. The sound is very loud in the silence. No one moves until she goes back to her own bunk and sits down to put the shoes on. As if this is a signal, there are several sighs, and some of the others start moving too, retrieving books for the next lesson, filing off to First Crucible, going over to the sideboard where breakfast waits. When Demaya goes to the sideboard herself, another girl glances at her, then away quickly. Sorry, she mutters. I'm the one who pushed you in the shower. Demaya looks at her and sees lurking fear making the skin around her eyes tight. It's okay, she says softly. Don't worry about it. The other grits never give Demaya trouble again. A few days later, Mashish returns with broken hands and haunted eyes. He never speaks to Demaya again. Jasper does not return, but Carnelian tells them he's been sent to the satellite fulcrum up in Arctic, since the fulcrum of Eumenes holds too many bad memories for him. This was meant as a kindness, perhaps, but Demaya knows an exile when she sees one. It could be worse, though. No one ever sees or mentions Crack again. fungus season. 602 Imperial. A series of oceanic eruptions during the eastern equatorial monsoons increased humidity in the region and obscured sunlight for 6 months. While this was a mild season as such things go, its timing created perfect conditions for a fungal bloom that spread across the equatorials into the northern and southern midlats, wiping out then-staple crop Mirok, now extinct. The resulting famine is included in the official geomestric record, extending the season's length to 4 years, 2 years for the fungus blight to run its course, 2 more for agriculture and food distribution systems to recover. Nearly all affected comms were able to subsist on their own stores, thus proving the efficacy of imperial reforms and seasonal planning. In its aftermath, many comms of the Nomidlats and Somidlats voluntarily joined the Empire, beginning its golden age. From The Seasons of Sansa. 12. Cyanite finds a new toy. "My colleague is ill," Cyanite tells Asael leadership Alia as she sits facing the woman across the desk. He sends his apologies for being unable to assist. "I will clear the blockage in your harbor."
"I'm sorry to hear of your senior's illness," says Asael with a little smile that almost makes Cyan's hackles rise. Almost, because she knew it was coming and could thus brace for it. It still rankles. "But I must ask," Asael continues, looking overly concerned, "will you be sufficient?" Her eyes flick down to Cyan's fingers, where Cyan has taken great care to put her rings on the 4 fingers a casual observer would be most likely to see. Her hands are folded, with the thumb of that hand tucked out of the way for the moment. Let Asael wonder if there is a 5th one there. But when Asael's eyes meet Cyan's again, Cyan sees only skepticism. She is unimpressed by 4 rings or even 5. "And this is why I will never ever take a mission with a 10-ringer again." Like she has a choice. She feels better thinking it anyway. Cyanite forces herself to smile, though she doesn't have Alabaster's knack for exaggerated politeness. She knows her smiles just look pissed off. "In my last mission," she says, "I was responsible for demolishing 3 buildings out of a block of 5. This was in downtown D-Bars, an area with several thousand inhabitants on a busy day, and not far from the 7th University." She uncrosses and recrosses her legs. The geomasts had driven her half mad on that mission, constantly demanding reassurances that she wouldn't create a shake any stronger than a 5.0. Sensitive instruments, important calibrations, something like that. It took 5 minutes, and no rubble landed outside the demolition zone. That was before I earned my latest ring. And she'd kept the shake to a 4, much to the geomasts' delight. "I'm pleased to hear you're so competent," says Asael. There is a pause, which makes Cyan brace herself. "With your colleague unable to contribute, however, I see no reason for Alia to pay for the services of 2 origins. "That's between you and the fulcrum," Cyan says dismissively. She honestly doesn't care. "I suspect you'll get an argument from them, because Alabaster is mentoring me on this trip and overseeing my work, even if he isn't actually doing it." "But if he isn't here, that's irrelevant." It galls, but Cyanite decides to explain. "He wears 10 rings. He'll be able to observe what I'm doing and intervene if necessary from his hotel room. He could do it while unconscious. Moreover, he's been quelling shakes in this area for the past few days as we traveled through it. That's a service he provides as a courtesy to local node maintainers, or to your comm, rather, since such a remote location doesn't have a node station nearby." As Azahel's expression tightens into a frown, probably at the perceived insult, Cyan spreads her hands. "The biggest difference between him and me is that I'm the one who needs to see what she's doing." I see.
Asael sounds deeply uneasy, as she should. Sion knows that it's the job of any fulcrum origin to ease the fears of the stills, and here Sion has exacerbated Asael's. But she's begun to develop a nasty suspicion about who in Alia might want Alabaster dead, so it's a good idea for her to dissuade Asael, or whoever Asael knows, from that plan. This pedantic minor bureaucrat has no idea how close her little city came to being flattened last night. In the uncomfortable silence that falls, Sionite decides it's time she asks some questions of her own, and maybe stirs the shit a little to see what rises to the top.
I see that the governor wasn't able to make it today.
Yes.
Asael's face goes gameswoman blank, all polite smile and empty eyes.
I did convey your colleague's request. Unfortunately, the governor was unable to make time in his schedule.
That's a shame.
And then, because Sionite is beginning to understand why Alabaster is such an ass about this, she folds her hands.
Unfortunately, it wasn't a request. Do you have a telegraph here? I'd like to send a message to the Fulcrum. Let them know we'll be delayed.
Asael's eyes narrow, because of course they have a telegraph, and of course Sionite meant that as another dig.
Delayed?
Well, yes. Sion raises her eyebrows. She knows she's not doing a good job of looking innocent, but she tries, at least.
How long do you think it will be before the governor is able to meet with us?
The Fulcrum will want to know. And she stands, as if to leave.
Asael tilts her head, but Sionite can see the tension in her shoulders.
I thought you were more reasonable than your colleague. You're actually going to walk out of here? And not clear our harbor in a fit of pique?
It isn't a fit of pique.
Now Sion's mad for real. Now she gets it. She looks down at Asael, who sits there, smug and secure in her big chair behind her big desk, and it's an actual fight to keep her fists from clenching, her jaw muscles from flexing.
Would you tolerate this treatment in our position?
Of course I would.
Asael straightens, surprised into an actual reaction for once.
The governor has no time for it.
No, you wouldn't tolerate it. Because if you were in my position, you'd be the representative of an independent and powerful organization, not some two-courts backwater flunky. You would expect to be treated like a skilled expert who's been learning her craft since childhood. Like someone who plies an important and difficult trade, and who's come to perform a task that dictates your comms' livelihood.
Asael is staring at her. Sionite pauses, takes a deep breath. She must stay polite and wield that politeness like a finely napped glass knife. She must be cold and calm in her anger, lest a lack of self-control be dismissed as the mark of monstrosity. Once the heat behind her eyes has eased, she steps forward.
And yet, you haven't shaken our hands, Asael leader.
You didn't look us in the eye when we first met. You still haven't offered that cup of safe that Alabaster suggested yesterday.
Would you do that to a decreed mest from the 7th University? Would you do it to a master engineer come to repair the comms hydro? Would you do it to a representative of the Strongbacks Union for your own comm?
Asael actually flinches as the analogies finally get through to her. Sionite waits, in silence, letting it gather pressure. Finally, Asael says,
I see.
Maybe you do. She keeps waiting, and Asael sighs.
What do you want, an apology?
Then I apologize. You must remember, though, that most normal people have never seen an origin, let alone had to do business as one, and... She spreads her hands.
Isn't it understandable that we might be uncomfortable?
Discomfort is understandable. It's the rudeness that isn't.
Rust this. This woman doesn't deserve the effort of her explanation.
Sion decides to save that for someone who matters. And that's a really shitty apology. I'm sorry you're so abnormal that I can't manage to treat you like a human being.
You're a Raga, Asael snaps, and then has the gall to look surprised at herself.
Well, Sine makes herself smile. At least that's out in the open.
She shakes her head and turns toward the door.
I'll come back tomorrow. Maybe you'll have had time to check the governor's schedule by then.
You are under contract, Asael says, her voice tight enough to quaver. You are required to perform the service for which we have paid your organization.
And we will.
Cyanite reaches the door and stops with her hand on the handle, shrugging.
But the contract doesn't specify how long we have upon arrival to get it done.
She's bluffing. She has no idea what's in the contract. But she's willing to bet Asael doesn't either. A deputy governor doesn't sound important enough to know that sort of thing.
Thanks for the stay at the season's end, by the way. The beds are very comfortable.
And the food's delicious. That, of course, does it. Asael stands as well.
Stay here. I'll go and speak with the governor.
So Sine smiles pleasantly and sits back down to wait.
Asael leaves the room and stays gone for long enough that Sine starts to doze off.
She recovers when the door opens again, and another coaster woman, elderly and portly, comes in with a chastened-looking Asael. The governor's a man. Sinite sighs inwardly and braces herself for more weaponized politeness.
Cyanite Orujin, the woman says, and despite her rising ire, Cyanite is impressed by the gravity of her presence. The Orujin after Cyan's name isn't necessary, of course, but it's a nice bit of much-needed courtesy. So Cyan rises, and the woman immediately steps forward and offers a hand for her to shake. Her skin is cool and dry and harder than Cyanite expected. No calluses, just hands that have done their share of everyday labor.
My name is Hera Smith Leadership Alia. I'm the Lieutenant Governor. The Governor genuinely is too busy to meet with you today, but I've cleared enough time on my schedule and I hope my greeting will be sufficient, especially as it comes with an apology for your poor treatment thus far.
I can assure you that Asael will be censured for her behavior.
To remind her that it's always good leadership to treat others, all others, with courtesy.
Well, the woman could be just playing a politician's game, or she could be lying about being the lieutenant governor. Maybe Asael's found a very well-dressed janitor to play the part. Still, it's an effort at compromise, and Cyan will take it.
Thank you, she says with genuine gratitude. I'll convey your apology to my colleague Alabaster.
Good. Please also tell him that Alia will pay your expenses per our agreed-upon contract for up to 3 days before and 3 days after your clearing of the harbor.
And there's an edge to her smile now, which Cyanite knows she probably deserves. This woman, it seems, actually has read the contract. Doesn't matter, though.
I appreciate the clarification.
Is there anything else you need during your stay?
Asael would be happy to provide a tour of the city, for example.
Damn, she likes this woman. She stifles the urge to smile and glances at Asael, who's managed to compose herself by this point. She gazes impassively back to Cyanite. And Cyan's tempted to do what Alabaster probably would, and take Hera Smith up on that tacit offer of Asael's humiliation. But Cyanite is tired, and this whole trip's been hellish, and the sooner it's over and she's back home at the fulcrum, the better.
No need, she says, and does Asael's face twitch a little in suppressed relief? I'd actually like to get a look at the harbor, if I may, so that I can assess the problem.
Of course. But surely you'd like refreshment first. At least a cup of safe.
Cyanite can't help it now. Her lips twitch.
I don't actually like safe, I should probably say.
No one does. and there's no mistaking the genuine smile on Harrismith's face. Anything else, then, before we go? Now it's Cyan's turn to be surprised. You're coming with us? Harrismith's expression grows wry.
Well, our comms livelihood is dependent on you, after all. It seems only proper.
Oh, yeah. This one's a keeper. Then please proceed, Harrismith leader.
Cyanite gestures toward the door, and they all head out.
The harbor's wrong. They're standing on a kind of boardwalk along the western curve of the harbor's half-circle. From there, most of Alia can be seen, spreading up the caldera slopes that surround the waterfront. The city really is quite lovely. It's a beautiful day, bright and warm, with a sky so deep and clear that Cyanite thinks the stargazing at night should be amazing. Yet it's what she can't see, under the water along the harbor bottom, that makes her skin crawl.
That's not coral, she says.
Harrismith and Asael turn to her, both of them looking puzzled.
Pardon, says Harrismith.
Cyanite moves away from them, going to the railing and extending her hands. She doesn't need to gesture, she just wants them to know she's doing something. A fulcrum origin always reassures clients of their awareness and understanding of the situation, even when those clients have no actual idea what's going on.
The harbor floor, the top layer is coral, she thinks.
She's never felt coral before, but it feels like what she expected. Layers of wriggling bright life that she can pull from if she needs to fuel her orogeny. And a solid core of ancient calcified death. But the coral heap sits atop a humped ridge in the floor of the harbor. And although it feels natural, there are usually folds like this in places where land meets sea, she's read. Cyanite can tell it's not. It's absolutely straight, for one thing, and huge. The ridge spans the width of the harbor. And more importantly, it isn't there. The rock beneath the raised layer of silt and sand, that is. She can't feel it. She should be able to, if it's pushing up the sea floor like this. She can feel the weight of the water atop it, and the rock deformed by its weight and pressure underneath, and the strata around it. But not the actual obstruction itself. There might as well be a big empty hole on the bottom of the harbor, around which the entire harbor floor has shaped itself. Cyanite frowns. Her fingers spread and twitch, following the flow and curve of the Sasuna. Soft slither of loosed schist and sand and organic matter. Cool press of solid bedrock, flow, and dip. As she follows it, she belatedly remembers to narrate her explorations. There's something beneath the coral, buried in the ocean floor, not far down. The rock underneath is compressed, it must be heavy. But why can't she feel it, if so? Why can she detect the obstruction only by its effect on everything nearby? It's strange.
Is it relevant?
That's Asael, maybe trying to sound professional and intelligent in order to get back into Harrismith's good graces.
All we need is for the coral blockage to be destroyed.
Yes, but the coral's on top of it. She searches for the coral and finds it all around the edges of the harbor. A theory forms. That's why this is the only place in the deep part of the harbor that's blocked by coral. It's growing on top of the thing, where the ocean floor has effectively been raised. Coral's a thing of the shallows, but it can get plenty of sun-warmed water along this ridge.
Rusting earth. Does that mean the coral will just grow back?
That's one of the men who came with Asael and Harrismith. They're a bunch of clerks, as far as Cyanite can tell, and she keeps forgetting they're present until they speak.
The whole point of this is to clear the harbor for good.
Cyanite exhales and relaxes her sesapine, opening her eyes so they'll know she's done. Eventually, yes, she says, turning to them. Look, here's what you're dealing with. This is your harbor. She cups her hand in an approximate circle, two-thirds closed. Alia's harbor is more irregular than this, but they get it. She sees as they step closer to her demonstration. So she lays the thumb of her right hand across the open part of the circle, almost, but not quite closing it off. This is the position of the thing. It's slightly elevated at one end, she wiggles the tip of her thumb, because there's a natural incline in the substrate. That's where most of the coral is. The waters at the far end of the thing are deeper and colder. Awkwardly, she waggles her hand to indicate the heel of her thumb. That's the open channel you've been using for port traffic. Unless this coral suddenly starts liking cold, dark water, or another variety of coral shows up that does, then that part may never become occluded. But even as she says this, it occurs to her. Coral builds on itself. New creatures grow on the bones of their predecessors. In time, that will lift even the colder part of the harbor into the zone of optimal growth. And with perfect timing, Azael frowns and says, Except that channel has been closing, slowly but surely, over the years. We have accounts from a few decades ago that say we used to be able to accommodate boats across the middle of the harbor. We can't anymore. Underfires. When Cyan gets back to the fulcrum, she's going to tell them to add rock-building marine life to the grit curriculum. Ridiculous that it's not something they learn already. If this comm's been around for many seasons, and you're only just now having this problem, then obviously this isn't the kind of coral that grows quickly. Aaliyah is only 2 seasons old, says Harrismith, with a pained smile at Cyan. That's a respectable achievement in and of itself. In the Midlats and Arctics, a lot of calms don't last a single season. The coasts are even more volatile. But of course, Harrismith thinks she's talking to a born and bred humanessen. Cyanite tries to remember the stuff she didn't sleep through in history creche. The choking season is the one that occurred most recently, a little over 100 years ago. It was mild as seasons have gone, killing mostly people in the Antarctic, near Mount Akok when it blew. Before that, was the acid season, or was it boiling? She always gets those two mixed up. Whichever one it was 200 or maybe 300 years before choking, and it was a bad one. Right. There were no seaside calms left after that one. So naturally, Alia can only be a few decades younger, founded when the waters sweetened and receded and left the coastline habitable again. So that coral blocked the harbor over the course of 400 years or so, Cyanite says, thinking out loud. Maybe with a setback during choking. How does coral survive a 5th season? She has no idea. But it clearly needs warmth and light to thrive, so it must have died back during that one. All right, let's say it really grew into a blockage over 100 years. Fire unto Earth, says another woman, looking horrified. You mean we might have to do this again in just 1 century? We will still be paying the fulcrum in 1 century, says Harrismith, sighing. And the look she throws Cyanite is not resentful, just resigned. Your superiors charge dearly for your services, I'm afraid. Cyanite resists the urge to shrug. It's true. They all look at each other, and then they look at her, and by this, Cyan knows. They're about to ask her to do something stupid. That's a very bad idea, she says preemptively, holding up her hands. Seriously, I've never shifted anything underwater before. That's why I had a senior assigned to me. Fat lot of good he's been. And more importantly, I don't know what that thing is. It could be a massive gas or oil pocket that will poison your harbor waters for years. It's not.
You know this because no oil or gas pocket is as perfectly straight and dense as this thing is, and because you can sense oil and gas. It could even be the remnant of some especially stupid dead sieve that seeded all its harbors with bombs. Oh, that was brilliant. They're staring at her now, horrified. She tries again.
Commission a study, she says. Bring in some geomasts who study marine floors. Maybe some engineers who know something about...
She waggles a hand, guesses wildly.
Ocean currents. Figure out all the positives and negatives. Then call in someone like me.
She hopes it won't be her again, specifically. Orogeny should always be your last resort, not your first.
That's better. They're listening.
Two of the ones she doesn't know start murmuring quietly to each other, and Harrismith has a thoughtful look on her face.
Azael looks resentful, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything bad. Azael's not very smart.
I'm afraid we have to consider it, says Harrismith at last, looking so deeply frustrated that Sinite feels sorry for her. We can't afford another contract with the Fulcrum, and I'm not certain we can afford a study. The Seventh University Engineer Licensure charge almost as much as the Fulcrum for their services. But most importantly, we can't afford to have the harbor blocked any longer. As you've guessed, we're already losing business to several other coaster ports that can accommodate the heavier riding freight vessels. If we lose accessibility altogether, there will be no reason for this calm to continue existing.
And I'm sympathetic, Sign begins. But then one of the men who've been murmuring in the background scowls at her.
You're also an agent of the Fulcrum, he says, and we contracted you to do a job.
Maybe he's not a clerk, then. I know that, and I'll do it right now if you want.
The coral is nothing, she knows, now that she's sussed it out. She can probably do that without rocking the boats and their moorings too much.
Your harbor can be usable tomorrow if I get rid of the coral today.
But you were hired to clear the harbor, says Asael. Permanently, not some temporary fix. If the problem has turned out to be bigger than you think, that's no excuse for not finishing the job.
Her eyes narrow.
Unless there's some reason you're so reluctant to shift the obstruction.
Sion resists the urge to call Asael one of several names.
I've explained my reasoning, leader. If it was my intention to cheat you in some way, why would I have told you anything about the obstruction? I would have just cleared the coral and let you figure it out the hard way when the stuff grows back.
That sways some of them, she can see. Both of the group's men stop looking so suspicious. Even Asael falters out of her accusatory stance, straightening a little in unease.
Harrismith, too, nods and turns to the others.
I think we'll need to discuss this with the governor, she says finally. Present him all the options.
Respectfully, Leader Harrismith, says one of the other women, frowning. I don't see another option. We either clear the harbor temporarily or permanently. Either way, we pay the Fulcrum the same amount.
Or you do nothing, Sinite says.
They all turn to stare at her, and she sighs. She's a fool to even mention this. Earth knows what the seniors will do to her if she scuttles this mission. She can't help it, though. These people face the economic destruction of their whole community. It's not a season, so they can move somewhere else, try to start over. Or they can dissolve, with all the comms families trying to find places in other communities.
Which should work, except for those family members who are poor or infirm or elderly. Or those who have uncles or siblings or parents who turned out to be origins. Nobody will take those.
Or if the community they try to join has too many members of their use caste already.
Or rusted.
If my colleague and I go back now, Sion continues in spite of everything, without doing anything,
Then we'll be in breach of contract. You'll be within your rights to demand your commission fee back, less our expenses for travel and local accommodations.
She's looking dead at Aseo as she says this. Aseo's jaw muscles flex.
Your harbor will still be unusable at least for a few years more. Use that time and the money you saved to either study what's happening and figure out what's down there, or move your calm to a better location.
That's not an option, says Aseo, looking horrified. This is our home.
Sion cannot help thinking of a fusty-smelling blanket.
Home is people, she says to Aseo, softly.
Aseo blinks.
Home is what you take with you, not what you leave behind.
Harrismith sighs.
That's very poetic, Sionite origin. But Aseo is correct. Moving would mean the loss of our calm's identity, and possibly the fracturing of our population. It would also mean losing everything we've invested in this location.
She gestures around, and Sionite understands what she means. You can move people easily, but not buildings, not infrastructure. These things are wealth, and even outside of a season, wealth means survival.
And there's no guarantee we won't face worse problems elsewhere.
I appreciate your honesty, I do, really.
But, well, better the volcano we know.
Sionite sighs. She tried. What do you want to do then?
It seems obvious, doesn't it?
It does. Evil Earth. It does.
Can you do it?
Asks Aseo.
And maybe she doesn't mean it as a challenge. Maybe she's just anxious. Because after all, what Sion is talking about here is the fate of the calm Aseo's been raised in and trained to guide and protect. And of course, as a leader-born child, Aseo would know nothing of this calm but its potential and welcome. She would never have reason to view her community with distrust or hatred or fear.
Sion doesn't mean to resent her, but she's already in a bad mood, and she's tired because she didn't get much sleep while saving Alabaster from poisoning the night before. And Aseo's question assumes that she is less than what she is. It's one time too many throughout this whole long, awful trip.
Yes, Sionite snaps, turning and extending her hands. You should all step back at least 10 feet.
There are gasps from the group, murmurs of alarm, and she feels them recede quickly along the unfolding map of her awareness. Hot, bright, jittering points moving out of easy reach.
They're still in slightly less easy reach, so is their whole calm, really. A cluster of motion and life all around her, so easy to grasp and devour and use. But they don't need to know that. She's a professional, after all.
So she stabs the fulcrum of her power into the earth in a sharp, deep point, so that her torus will be narrow and high, rather than wide and deadly. And then she probes around the local substrate again, searching for the nearest fault or perhaps a remnant bit of heat from the extinct volcano that once formed Alia's caldera. The thing in the harbor is heavy, after all. She's going to need more than ambient power to shift it. But as she searches, something very strange and very familiar happens. Her awareness shifts. Suddenly, she's not in the earth anymore. Something pulls her away and over and down and in. And all at once, she's lost, flailing about in a space of black, constricting cold. And the power that flows into her is not heat or motion or potential, but something entirely else. Something like what she felt last night, when Alabaster commandeered her orogeny. But this isn't Alabaster. And she's in control, sort of. That is, she can't stop what's happening. She's taken in too much power already. If she tries to let go,
She'll ice half the calm and set off a shake that makes the shape of the harbor academic. But she can use the flood of power. She can steer it, for example, into the rock bed underneath the thing she can't see. She can push up, which lacks finesse and efficiency, but gets the rusting job done. And she can feel the enormous blankness that is the object rise in response. If Alabaster's observing from his inn room, he must be impressed. But where's the power coming from? How am I... She can realize, belatedly and with some horror, that water moves much like rock in response to a sudden infusion of kinetic energy. But it's much, much faster to react. And she can react herself, faster than she's ever done before, because she's brimming with strength. It's practically coming out of her pores, an earth fire. It feels unbelievably good. It is child's play to stop the massive wave that's building and about to swamp the harbor. She just dissipates its force, sending some back out to sea, channeling the rest into soothing the waters as the thing from the ocean floor breaks free of its encumbering sediment and the coral, which just slides off and shatters, and begins to rise. But the thing isn't doing what she wants it to do. She intended to just shunt it to the side of the harbor. That way, if the coral grows back, it still won't block the channel. Instead, evil earth, what the rust? Instead, it's moving on its own. She can't hold it. When she tries, all the power that she held just trickles away, sucked off somewhere as quickly as it infused her. Sion falls back into herself then, gasping as she sags against the wooden railing of the boardwalk. Only a few seconds have passed. Her dignity will not allow her to fall to her knees, but the railing's the only thing keeping her up. And then she realizes no one will notice her weakness, because the boards beneath her feet and the railing she's clinging to are all rattling in an ominous sort of way. The shake siren begins wailing, deafeningly loud, from a tower right behind her. People are running on the quays below the boardwalk and the streets around it. If not for the siren, she would probably hear screams. With an effort, Sion lifts her head to see Asael, Harrowsmith, and their party hurrying away from the boardwalk, keeping well away from any buildings, their faces stark with fear. Of course, they leave Sionite behind. But that is not the thing that finally pulls Sion out of self-absorption. What does is a sudden spray of seawater that wafts across the quays like rain, followed by a shadow that darkens this whole side of the harbor. She turns. There, rising slowly from the water and shedding the remnants of its earthen shell as it begins to hum and turn, is an obelisk. It's different from the one Sion saw last night. That one, the purple one, she thinks is still a few miles off coast, though she doesn't look that way to confirm its presence. The one before her dominates all her vision, all her thought, because it's rusting huge, and it's not even completely out of the water yet. Its color is the deep red of garnets, its shape a hexagonal column with a sharp-pointed, irregular tip. It is completely solid, not shimmering or flicking in the half-real way of most obelisks. It is wider than several ships put end-to-end. And, of course, it is long enough as it continues to rise and turn to nearly block off the whole harbor, a mile from tip to tip. But something's wrong with it, which becomes clear as it rises. At the midpoint of the shaft, the clear crystalline beauty of the thing gives way to cracks, massive ones, ugly and black-tinged, as if some contaminant from the seafloor has seeped in during all the centuries that the thing must have lain down there. The jagged, spidering lines spread across the crystal in a radiant pattern. Sionite can feel how the obelisk's hum jitters and stutters here, incomprehensible energies struggling through the place of damage. And at the center of the radiating cracks, she can see some kind of occlusion. Something small. Sinite squints, leaning harder on the railing as she cranes her neck to follow the rising moat. Then the obelisk turns a little more as if to face her. And all at once, her blood ices over, as she realizes what she's seeing. A person. There's someone in the thing, stuck like a bug in amber, limbs splayed and still, hair a frozen spray. She can't make out the face, not quite, but in her imagination the eyes are wide, the mouth open, screaming. That's when she realizes she can make out an odd marbling along the figure's skin, black bruised through the dark red of the shaft. The sunlight flickers, and she realizes its hair is clear, or at least translucent enough to be lost in the garnet around it. And there's just something about what she's seeing. Something maybe she knows because for a moment she was a part of this obelisk. That's where the power was coming from. Something she won't question too deeply because, evil Earth, she can't take this. The knowledge is there in her mind, impossible to deny, no matter how much she might want to. When the reasoning mind is forced to confront the impossible again and again, it has no choice but to adapt. So she accepts that what she is looking at is a broken obelisk that has lain unknown on the floor of Alia's harbor for Earth knows how long. She accepts that what is trapped at its heart, what has somehow broken this massive, magnificent, arcane thing, is a stone eater. And it's dead. Father Earth thinks in ages, but he never ever sleeps. Nor does he forget. From Tablet 2, The Incomplete Truth, Verse 2. 13. You're on the trail. This is what you are at the vein, this small and petty creature. This is the bedrock of your life. Father Earth is right to despise you, but do not be ashamed. You may be a monster, but you are also great. The calmless woman is called Tonki. That's the only name she gives you. No use name, no calm name. You're sure she is, despite her protestations, a geomast. She admits it, sort of, when you ask her why she's following you. He's just too damn interesting, Tonki says, jerking her chin toward Hoa. If I didn't try to figure him out, my old masters at the uni would hire assassins to hunt me down. Not that they haven't done that already. She laughs like a horse, all bray and big white teeth. I'd love a sample of his blood, but that lot of good that will do me without proper equipment. So I'll settle for observation. Hoa looks annoyed at this, and pointedly makes an effort to keep you between himself and Tonki as you walk. The uni she referred to, you are certain, is the 7th university in Deepars, the most famous center of learning for mests and lorists in all the stillness, located in the 2nd largest city of the Equatorials. And if that prestigious place is where Tonki trained, rather than at some jumped-up regional creche for adults, or at the knee of some local tinkerer, then she has fallen very far indeed. But you're too polite to say this aloud. Tonki does not live in an enclave of cannibals, despite her creative threats. You discover this when she leads you to her home that afternoon. Her home is a cave situated in a vesicle, the ancient fallen-in remains of a solidified lava bubble, this one once as big as a small hill. Now it's a secluded glen in a pocket of forest, with curving columns of gleaming black glass interspersed among the trees. There are all sorts of odd little cavelets tucked into its sides, where smaller bubbles must have nestled against the larger, and Tonki warns you that some of the ones on the far side of the vesicle are home to forest cats and other animals.
Most of them are no threat, normally. But everything changes in a season. So you're careful to follow Tonki's lead. Tonki's cavern is full of contraptions, books, and junk she's scavenged, amid a lot of actually useful things like lanterns and store cache food. The cavern smells of fragrant resins from the fires she's burned, but it quickly takes on Tonki's stench once she's in and bustling about. You resign yourself to endure it, though Hoa doesn't seem to notice or maybe care. You envy his stoicism. Fortunately, it turns out that Tonki did indeed bring all that water with her for a bath. She does this in front of you, shamelessly stripping down and squatting by a wooden basin to scrub at her pits and crotch and the rest. You're a little surprised to notice a penis somewhere amid this process. But, well, not like any calm's going to make her a breeder. She finishes up by rinsing her clothes and hair with a murky green solution that she claims is antifungal. You have your doubts. Anyway, the place smells much better when she's done, so you spend a remarkably pleasant and cozy night there on your bedroll. She's got spares, but you don't want to risk lice. And even let Hoa curl up against you, though you turn your back to him so he won't cuddle. He does not try. The next day you resume the journey south, with Tonki the calmless geomast and Hoa the... whatever he is. Because you're pretty sure by now that he's not human. That doesn't bother you. Officially speaking, you're not human either. Per the second Eumenescin lore council's Declaration on the Rights of the Orogenically Afflicted, 1,000-ish years ago. What does bother you is that Hoa won't talk about it. You ask about what he did to the Kirkuza, and he refuses to answer. You ask him why he won't answer, and he just looks miserable and says, "Because I want you to like me." It almost makes you feel normal, traveling with these two. The road demands most of your attention in any case. The ashfall only gets heavier over the next few days, until you finally do pull the masks out of your runny sack. You have four, fortunately, horribly, and hand them around. It's clumpy ash for now, not the floating haze of death that stone lore warns against, but no sense being incautious. Other people have broken out their masks, too. You see when they materialize out of the grayness, their skin and hair and clothing hardly distinguishable from the ash-painted landscape, their eyes grazing over you and away. The masks make everyone equally unknown and unknowable, which is good. No one pays attention to you or Hoa or Tonki, not anymore. You're happy to join the indistinct masses. By the end of a week, the crowds of people traveling along the road have begun to thin into knots and occasionally trickles. Everyone who has a calm is hurrying back there, and the thinning crowds mean most of them are finding somewhere to settle in. Now only those journeying farther than usual remain on the road, or people who don't have a home to return to, like the hollow-eyed equatorials you've seen, many of them sporting terrible burns or injuries that come from falling debris. The equatorials are a brewing problem, because there's a lot of them on the road, even if the injured ones are mostly getting sick with infection and starting to die. You pass at least one or two people every day who just sit there on the edges of the road, pale or flushed, curled up or shaking, waiting for the end to come. There's plenty left who seem hale enough, though, and they're calmless now. That's always a problem. You talk to a small group of these folks at the next roadhouse. Five women of wildly varied ages, and a very young, uncertain-looking man. This lot have removed most of the flowing, uselessly pretty garments that people in the equatorial cities used to consider fashionable, you notice. Somewhere along the way, they've stolen or traded for sturdy clothes and proper travel gear. But each of them sports some remnant of the old life. The oldest woman wears a headscarf of frilly stained blue satin.
The youngest has gauzy sleeves poking out from under the heavier, more practical cloth of her tunic. The young man has a sash around his waist that is soft and peach-colored, and they are solely for decoration as far as you can tell.